This is Jennifer Yushkevich interviewing Stephen Mayhew. So the first question, when did you join RSA?
Apparently, my first RSA meeting was 1994 in Norfolk. But I had heard of the RSA before that time. And since that's one of the questions, it was as a graduate student in the Rhetoric, Linguistics, and Literature program of Ross Winthrop that I first heard about RSA. And I sort of backed into the RLL, as it was called, because this we're talking about the mid-1970s. Yes, that long ago. And I was interested in studying American literature, went to USC, University of California, after graduating from Loyola University of Los Angeles, and ended up wanting to, when theory hit, continental philosophy being imported into the United States through English and comparative literature departments. And when I went to look to find out how to study theory along with American Lit, I found out that it wasn't possible to do it with the history of criticism course that was being offered that we were required to take. So Ross established this new program called Rhetoric, Linguistics, and Literature. You had to specialize in composition, linguistics, or literature. Most people went into it to specialize in composition. But I was teaching RetCom, but I was not really interested in pursuing that as my major area. So went into Ross and said, I'd like to study theory. And is there any chance if I went into your program, I could do that? He was very, very nice and welcoming. And so I was in the first cohort of the RLL program. But whereas everybody else was specializing in comp, I chose to literature. But got a lot of rhetoric and composition along the way, both in my teaching and in the courses that we were taking. The courses were those that were also taught in the speech communication department, which is right next door to the English department. So I took courses from, or sat in on courses with Walt Fisher. And so I was getting Ross Winthrop from English, Walt Fisher, and others, along with various people that were doing theory. Stanley Fish came by one year, was there for a year, and he was very influential in what. But it was mostly theory that I was interested in, and how one could do cultural studies and in American Lit. The rhetoric was just kind of extra thing that I was interested in, but especially for my teaching, but not as a scholarly field. And I remember, I still remember having in our mailbox the announcement of this new organization called the Rhetoric Society of America, because Ross Winthrop was one of the founders of that society. And the it said something like, I think he wrote, there was the announcement, and then he wrote something on it, and it was something like to all the people that were in RLL, and maybe other graduate students as well, but I know it's specifically for the RLL. It says, do you know about this new organization? Stop. If you do, are you a member? Stop. If not, why not? Okay. I think I remember that very vividly, but I didn't become a member. That wasn't my thing. Was what became literary theory, critical theory. I was interested in reader response criticism. Worked with Stanley Fish, wrote about Wolfgang Iser, Jonathan Culler, all of these people. Fish at that time was not really doing rhetoric per se explicitly, but it was Ross and the other people in the program, Mike Fian, Tim Crucius, and others that were doing Kenneth Burke in theory, and so I did get interested somewhat, I can see, but I did not join RSA. Fast forward, the So that would be in the 70s. So all the way through the 80s, as I became interested in my second, after my first, my dissertation was published as Interpretive Conventions in 82, I like to say that the proposal that I had for my next book, which got funded by the NEH, was based on a certain theoretical perspective that I was becoming more and more skeptical about. And I got this fellowship, got hired at the University of Miami. My first job was at Temple University. I got hired at the University of Miami, and they gave me the first semester off because of this NEH. And what I had proposed, I no longer believed in. And so I like to say rhetoric saved me. So all these courses that I'd taken and the interest I'd gotten then started developing, and I started working on what became cultural rhetoric study, rhetorical hermeneutics, and that's where I started situating my work as not just U.S. cultural studies and critical theory, but rhetoric. And I think that during the 80s, I'm not quite sure why, I never... I'm pretty sure I went to Four C's sometimes, and I was a regular member of MLA, but I don't think I went to RSA. So what I find in looking back at notes and my CV and stuff is the first time I went to RSA was to talk about sophistry and rhetorical pragmatism in 1994.
Who did you present with? Who were some of the people that you were seeing around you? Do you remember? Early on?
Yeah, I don't. I know that Susan Jarrett, the sophistry was really important, but I don't really recall too much about those really early days of who I was working with. And so it was important. I mean, I had no memory of this until I looked back at this. But it was important to. Work on the history of rhetoric in relationship to sophistry, because this allowed a way of historicizing theory for me. And the sophists were a good example of one could talk about the sophists in relationship to post-structuralism. And so I remember Susan's work, and I think that Susan Jarrett would be one of the really people that was important for me in seeing here's somebody who could do feminism, feminist theory, and real solid history. I think I probably started also maybe going to Isher, International Society of History of Rhetoric, during those years as well, because there was that was another way to do history and theory. Victor Batanza was using the term the third sophistic, and I remember being interested in that. Again, the combination of theory with rhetoric.
So then one of the key features for RSA for you was the way it mixed theory and rhetoric.
That was one of the ways, but it was also, and this has been true all the way along. My wife teases me about over many years going to conferences and never going to the sessions, because it's more about, you know, it'd be about seeing old graduate student friends and, you know, and preparing for your, maybe you didn't write the paper until you're there. So there are all kinds of reasons. But Isher and RSA are two of the conferences that consistently I would go to, partly because the whole reason I got into being a professor in the first place is it was the only job I could think of where I could be a perpetual student. And RSA and Isher have provided opportunities not only for networking, seeing people that I'm interested in, but actually going to sessions on something entirely different that I, you know, and seeing where the conversation is. As I say with my graduate students, if you want to enter into publishing, you need to know where the conversation is, and so that's been consistent. It's true today. Of going to RSA and learning new things.
So when you look back, and I know you said you had to consult your notes,
yeah.
But when you look back on your time in RSA, at any point, are there particular memories or moments that stand out to you?
Yeah, there's a couple. One is that, let's see, it was 2000. Well, there was a couple of things. So when Carolyn Miller became editor of RSQ, she asked me to, I think I joined the editorial board of RSQ at that point. She asked me for one of the inaugural issues to do something on, I don't know if she said, apply rhetorical hermeneutics to the history of the disciplines of speech communication, English, and composition. But I was interested in identity formation and the performance of identity. So I was working on racial identities and cultural studies and the performance of race, and developed a notion of identity as identity as interpreting yourself, as how others interpret you and how you interpret yourself through how others interpret you, and applied it to some of the William S. Scarborough, the first African-American member of the MLA. But he was basically a classicist. And I was interested in the way that he self-identified as an African-American, but also as a classicist. And there were times, as the only member of the American Classical Association, that he would say, at least in his memoirs, that he was respected for what he did in classics, and his racial identity was secondary to his professional identity. Now, you know, that would be in giving the paper, but when you go to the hotel to get a room, it was a very different matter. So I was interested in the power of disciplinary identities, and so Carolyn gave me this opportunity to write about that, and I did a kind of history of how the fragmentation of rhetoric in the 20th century, and she published that as in that inaugural issue, and RSA gave me some opportunities then to, there were some responses from both sides about how I didn't get it right, and so there was one of the conjunction of those of publishing on disciplinary identity, which eventually became a book, but that I was responding to some of the critiques from these disciplines. But here you have people from communication studies and composition that you wouldn't get at the same conference, but RSA you would, you know. And so that's just was one memory. When David Zareski took over as, let's see, when would that have been? When he took over as president, he asked me to give the keynote and at one of the RSAs. And so I gave the keynote, and I still remember the large audience of, you know, when we have one of these keynotes, and I started off with a clip from West Wing that ended with the president criticizing a priest's interpretation of St. Paul in his homily, and it ended up by saying, hacks, off the stage. And so I started with that, and I said, I know this is dangerous to be starting with this kind of critique, and don't want you to be saying that I'm a hack. This should be off the stage. And then went on to talk about the role of rhetoric at that particular moment. So that was a sort of memorable moment doing the keynote for RSA. And then I was one of the four speakers when RSA really was the main sponsor of ARS, the Alliance for Rhetorical Societies. And so that was in 2003. And I gave a paper called Places in Time, the Inns, INNS, and Outhouses of Rhetoric. This was brought together a lot of people from from RSA meetings and members of the association to this great conference that we had in September of 2003 at Northwestern. And so I still remember giving that talk and Jim Ani responding to it. And his line was something like, it's very difficult to respond. It's a challenge to respond to a paper by Steve Mayu. He always says niceness to power. This nice little double-edged compliment critique. And there was some truth, definitely some truth. And then he went on to give a great talk. And Mike Leff was who had been really instrumental for me, another important person in Isher and RSA for me, because he helped me to cross the disciplinary bind. It's not directly relevant to RSA, but I just always thought that since I did rhetoric, it's going to be really easy going to the National Communication Association, or I guess then it was called the Speech Communication. And it was just, it was like going to alien time. I didn't know the acronyms. I didn't know the key people. I didn't get the jokes. And so it was an interesting example of something that you think it's going to be real. They do rhetoric, I do rhetoric. You know, but the disciplinary identities were and histories were very, very different. RSA brings those together, and so that what you find over the years is that I can't always tell when I'm talking to somebody what disciplinary training they've had, because we're sharing a certain interdisciplinary ground and a membership in a society that sees itself as interdisciplinary.
So, bearing that in mind, how do you think that RSA has changed over time?
That's hard because, you know, I found that, you know, I've gone and been a part. I was on the board of directors in around 2000 on the editorial board of RSQ. I was gave a seminar at the first institute. I think Keith Gilliard was the other person there, you know, and my relation to RSA in terms of what's changed has to do with things that are very important, but not in terms of ideas. It's in terms of how large it is now, how there are people, younger people that I don't recognize. But so much of it is the same for me, because many of the people, even though some are retiring and they, you know, have been here. Now, I can't remember. Somebody came up to me at the reception and said, "Oh, I so remember when you and Wayne Booth were put together and were debating and da 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 da." I just wanted to check something. You know, at a certain point, you stepped back and said, "Well, yeah, maybe you're right about that, Wayne." And Wayne then declared, "I won." And so I just wanted to make sure that I understood what the point was. I have no memory of that. And I said, "Are you sure that it was me that you know?" Because I had a lot of respect for Wayne Booth, and over the years we did in fact talk, and there were some public sessions probably at RSA that were where we had exchanges, but I don't remember being on the same panel with him, and so I was no help at all in filling in the blanks. But seeing people that have now passed on, Rossman Road, others, Wayne, that no longer are on the stage, but there are many that continue to be in the same scene, and that's a kind of continuity for me. Certainly interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary, even transdisciplinary discussions that have gone have always been there, and you know, I don't really, certainly the topics that we discuss have changed. The theoretical terrain certainly has changed.
How?
Well, theory remembering, I've been around for a really long time here, so when theory hit in the 70s and 80s, and I finally went from Syracuse University, where we changed the curriculum in the 80s from a literature center to critical theory and cultural studies. You know, this was, I mean, not that we were national news, but curriculum reform, because of theory and cultural critique, was national news about changing the curriculum, expanding the canon, redefining what counts as basic knowledge of West, expanding it to more global, all these things, informed by theory. Theory was something that everybody had to know about. It was the cutting edge of thought. And that, you know, lasted through the 80s into the 90s, and I left Syracuse after we successfully changed the curriculum to UC Irvine, basically one of the centers, so to speak, a decentered center of theory where people like Jacques Derrida, Hillis Miller, Murray Krieger were my colleagues, Wolfgang Ieser, who I'd written about in my dissertation. And in my courses there, and I was really the first person that they hired that was at least a fellow traveler with rhetoric and composition. And it was really a big deal for UCI, who saw composition as a service, not a scholarly field. And so they hired me as a kind of bridge person between rhetoric and composition taught by lecturers and contingent faculty and the rest of the department, who was into literature, cultural studies, and theory. And so there I was able to bring to bear rhetoric in a way with support of surprising people that I didn't necessarily. Hillis Miller was a big supporter, and so at that point, rhetoric was theory. In the theory courses I taught, people from economics or from business school or from law school, theory was, if you were in your discipline, no matter what your profession, it was what you needed to know, even if it was to be able to fight against people that were theory heads. You know, you needed to know it. And so at that point, theory in across rhetorical studies was also really a big deal, and that just is no longer the case. Okay, it's not that theory doesn't make a difference anymore within the RSA, but it's not within just in general in the university landscape in the seen as the cutting edge. Okay, now particular theories have developed, and so that would be, so there'd be that one change, which is a kind of, for me, a kind of nostalgic, boy, that those theory days were, you know, high theory, that was, and you could find that whether it was the MLA or NCA or RSA or not so much Isher, but Wayne Booth made attempts there. One can't assume that people will see theory, especially post-structuralist versions of it, as the what you need to engage when you're doing your work. Specific theories, though, influenced by that, the new materialisms, certain kinds of feminisms, certain kinds of ecological criticism, certainly digital media theoretical frameworks are all influenced by all of this, but those are individual theoretical perspectives, as pervasive as they are, again, across disciplines, but it's not the same power that theory had. And so that's kind of been a change in RSA. I don't think, but it's not just RSA. It's more the larger intellectual landscape.
So how do you think RSA is going to continue to change moving ahead?
I know that this particular conference that we've had this weekend has made me think a little bit differently about what that might mean. Two things particular, and one is a little embarrassing. But when David Zarefsky and Greg, I think it was Greg Clark, at least it was a couple of people, brought up RSA as an umbrella group, that that showed showed me that because I'm no longer on the board, and maybe I've been a little negligent about going over the last couple of years to business sessions and things like that, I hadn't thought of it that way, but because I was part of the ARS, and there was a lot of nervousness about what they said, the poaching of, and so RSA kind of stepped back and from it. And so ARS was seen as the alliance of all the rare sides. RSA was just one. But then, as David said, there wasn't planned to have any more conferences of ARS, as important as that conference was, and it was a great conference. Very memorable to me, as I said. But I see in retrospect, yeah, I guess it is that RSA kind of took over the umbrella thing, but I just didn't kind of notice that is. Even though people like Mike Leff said, let's have some representation of RSA at the MLA, the Modern Language Association. So there was a session that we did in right after ARS that was ARS Revisited, like that. So I guess then RSA saw itself more, at least the leadership saw itself more as this umbrella group, and I now see that I guess that's what I've been part of, but I didn't quite realize it, you know, and when I think about it, that's why Isher has been having a seminar, so I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't quite realize that RSA, so that's one important thing. The other thing is that there's been some talk about possible ways that the rhetoric societies or RSA or other kinds of associations of learned societies might be able to comment on the current media political scene of hyper-partisan politics and so I've come away, and so there's been some meetings, people talk about that here, and so I've come away thinking that might be something that I'll be participating in through RSA. And then this isn't really a change. It's a change, but it's not something that I wasn't already aware of this weekend, but I see as the future, and that's the relationship of rhetoric and religion. And I think that's going to be something that in the future RSA is going to be a great site. I've gone to a couple sessions during the weekend, and so I'm hoping, since that's what my particular work is right now, working on Kenneth Burke, critical theory and Jesuit rhetoric, I'm hoping that's going to continue, and so this will be a great venue for that to happen, because it's also interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, and cross-disciplinary.
So what are your hopes for the organization's future? Is it to...
Yeah, I think my hopes are that it would continue to be a site where from all... I wish there was even more disciplines. I wish there were more anthropologists, political scientists, psychology, sociology, in my own philosophy, that literature that were coming to RSA, that we could even be more multidisciplinary, so that more kinds of talks. And I think that RSA is really open to that, and one of the great places where those kinds of discussions can take place. I hope that RSA continues to figure out various publishing venues for its members, and so that RSA series on transdisciplinary rhetorics, where I published my last book, Rhetorics Pragmatism, those kinds of opportunities on transdisciplinary, and some of the books that have come out of that series. I really feel honored to be part of it. So I hope that continues. I hope that the initiatives that some people were talking about of RSA possibly leading the way, or at least being a big participant in some kind of public statement, some kind of intervention in contemporary politics, using our rhetorical expertise, both theoretically and practically. I'm always going to want to hope that theory of various kinds continues. That's something I'm nostalgic about, but I think that it also continues to have the new materialisms, for example, some of which I'm very not opposed to, but skeptical of, or at least critique of it. But having a dialogue on something like humanism or rhetorical humanism beyond posthumanism, this is the place where I can have that dialogue, and that sense of a possibility for the future is what I hope continues both theoretically and practically. And so I'm hoping that I'll be able to go to a few more of these RSAs and feel that I can continue as a student as well as some kind of contributor to the ongoing conversation.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.